You're listening to a 95BFM podcast. You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Hello. Tēnā koe, tēnā koutou. Kia ora, ko tū whenua oroa nātani hira, tōko ingoa, nau mai hare mai ki The Wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora, sorry about that, little bit of a hiccup there with the audio. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 18th of September. I'm Tū, and I'm joined in studio today by the always great Alan Blackman. He's got the... He's probably got, I think, the best laugh out of all the guests we get here at 95BFM. And as well as Alan, hello, Will.
Greetings.
How you doing, buddy?
Good, good.
That's very good. So, I'm joined by those two in the studio today. If I can, coming up on your show today on Dear Science with AUT's Alan Blackman, we talk French postmen and their testicles, the number 42, and deadly sinking sludge. Interesting. Will speaks to Jared Abbott about recent cotton on worker strikes on Queen Street, and I have a report on the Operation Birmingham inquiries and why you should probably pay attention to it. Ko e wari wari e ahe ana koutou ki te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero ana hei pakihere rokiroki mā runga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95bfm.com. So you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātuhi mai, you can text in at 595. Why am I nā rānei? Or give us a call in studio at 309-3879. Let's get into it.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Hello, Alan.
Hello, too.
What are we talking about first today?
Well, we're going to talk about the Ig Nobel Prizes.
The Ig Nobel Prizes.
The Ig Nobel Prizes. Because next month is Nobel Prize Month,
yes.
So sort of the first week in October. And for the past 29 years, in the month prior to that, they have awarded these things called the Ig Nobel Prizes. Now, these were originally introduced for work, quote, that cannot or should not be reproduced. But now it's gone a bit wider than that. And now they are to, quote, honor achievements that first make people laugh and then make them think.
So I'm not sure if you know much about the Oscars, but they have a sort of an award ceremony that precedes that. It's called the Razzies.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
And so these are sort of the Razzies.
The Razzies of the Nobel. I like that, actually. That works.
Okay.
That works very well.
Except,
I mean, the Razzies are for bad sort of stuff. Aren't
right.
They, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas this, as it says, these are real science. These prizes are given for real science that actually has been done and published in peer-reviewed journals, but as it says, it makes people laugh and then it makes them think. So, without further ado, the areas in which they are awarded are not necessarily the same as the actual Nobel Prizes themselves. So
okay.
they sort of come and go every year. I guess the big one this year was the prize in anatomy, the anatomy prize. And this is the one that caught everybody's attention. And this was awarded to a guy called by the name of Roger Musier, and he's a fertility specialist at the University of Toulouse. And he got the award for measuring scrotal temperature asymmetry in naked and clothed postmen in France.
All right. What does that mean? Can you explain that, please?
So what he wanted to do. So as I say, he's a fertility specialist, and apparently he has invented a pair of heated underwear as a contraception device, apparently. So he reckons the temperature of your boys makes a difference to whether they're sort of fully operational or not.
So the risk of sounding quite crass. So he's basically made an oven to kill all the little... The little mini me's in there.
Well, that's his invention. So he is very interested in the temperature of your fellas and seeing whether that makes a difference to obviously how they work. So, for some reason, and I didn't figure this out by reading it, he enrolled a whole lot of French postmen.
So I was going to ask why.
Yes, postman? I know. and I have no idea why the postman. But basically what he did was he put little temperature sensors down there and measured the temperatures of the left and the right when the postmen were both clothed and naked. And what he found was that the left is warmer than the right, but only when you've got clothes on.
Oh, and why is this significant? Why does it matter that the left is slightly warmer than your right?
I think you're going to have to ask him that because I have utterly no idea. But again, this was published in a peer-reviewed journal, so there you go.
Enlightening.
Now, there are other prizes, lest we get hooked on testicles. The economics prize went to researchers from Turkey and the Netherlands and Germany, and they got this for testing which country's money is best at transmitting bacteria.
Oh, and what was the outcome of that?
And the outcome of that was the Romanian loo. So if you go to Romania, be wary of the money there because it's very good at transmitting bacteria, apparently.
Okay, so don't lick the coins.
No.
Okay.
Indeed. The Peace Prize went to workers from the UK, Saudi, Singapore, and the USA for, quote-unquote, trying to measure the pleasurability of scratching an itch. So they were trying to find where on the body it's best to scratch, where it's most relieving.
And where is that?
What do you reckon?
I think the nose. Personally, I like a good little nose scratch.
I would have thought the elbow.
No, neither. It's the ankles.
Oh, okay.
The ankle scratch followed by the back and followed by the forearm.
What's your favourite?
Oh, hell. I haven't given it any thought, actually. So I'm gonna remain neutral on that one. I really don't know. But wherever the bug has bitten me probably is the best.
That sounds good. All right, so...
A couple more. Medicine prize went to Italians and Dutch for collecting evidence that pizza might protect against illness and death if the pizza is made and eaten in Italy.
What? So just so what you're trying to tell me is just stick to Domino's.
I don't think Domino's is made in Italy somehow, but yeah.
Okay.
And finally, the chemistry prize went to a Japanese worker for estimating the total volume of saliva produced per day by a typical 5-year-old child.
Now that one seems the least useful out of all of those that you listed.
But again, it has been published. It's of interest to somebody. So how much do we reckon?
How much of interest to me?
Yeah, well, no, how much saliva do you reckon in a day from a 5-year-old?
A litre.
Half a litre.
Ooh,
yeah.
Close.
That's
yeah.
still a lot of saliva.
That is.
And that's a pint.
And now that you start thinking about it, are you not doing that? Are you sort of salivating?
Well, I am now.
Yeah,
now that
I know,
you mention
exactly,
it.
Once you mention that, you can't stop. So anyway, so that's the Ig Nobel Prizes and, annual occurrence. Go and have a look at the website if you're interested because, as I say, this is all bona fide research that has been done and it's been done for a reason, while that's not necessarily obvious in all cases. So.
Well, at least it's all above board. So our next story today is using crowdsourced computers.
Yep.
University of Bristol mathematician has solved the last, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce that, one of the last equations of the number 42.
Okay, the Diophantine.
Diophantine, yes. There you go.
Okay, so everybody has read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I'm assuming.
I've seen the movie.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, very good book. The spacecraft hung in the air like bricks don't. That's one of the great lines from that. I like that. But anyway, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is all about the number 42 and the meaning of life, etc., etc. And it so happens that there has been a problem in mathematics since the sort of the mid-50s. These sort of Diophantine equations, of which there are many, but one of them is that apparently you can express many numbers as the sum of three cubes. So you cube a number, you cube another number, you cube another number, add them together, and that expresses a particular number. So what we have got is all the numbers from 1 to 100... now, many of them can be expressed like this. So, for example, 3 can be expressed as 1 cubed plus 1 cubed plus 1 cubed. Okay? Or, for example, 99 can be expressed as 2 cubed, which is 8, plus 3 cubed, which is 27, plus 4 cubed, which is 64. So, basically, there are many numbers from 1 to 100 that you can express in these sorts of equations, and this is sounding really bloody dull at the moment.
Well, I wish that the listeners could see my bloody face right now because I'm just looking at you like.
I'd reason to guess that most of the people that work at BFM have failed math in high school or didn't do well at it. That's why we're here.
So, So the story is that, well, okay, for another example, okay, let's take the number 2. 2 can be expressed as...
Hey, I like that number.
That's a good number, okay. So, very good. That can be expressed as the sum of 3 cubes. It's just that those numbers that you're going to cube are 1,214,928, 3,480,205, and negative 3,528,875. So if you add up those cubes, you'll get 2. Okay? Mm. Right, so the lowest numbers that couldn't be or hadn't yet been expressed in terms of this were 33 and 42. And 33 was done earlier this year, and that was done on a supercomputer. So that takes an awful lot of computing power to actually do this, and obviously you spend an awful lot of money as well. And that left 42 as the only number that should be able to be expressed as this, but hadn't yet, or the lowest number that hadn't yet been expressed like that. So instead of using a supercomputer, you're correct, one of... A worker decided to go sort of the crowdsourcing route, where he would hook into basically people's personal PCs and utilize their processing power rather than having to use a supercomputer. And this is the same type of computer usage that is used in the SETI project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Yeah.
Okay, so where they're taking truckloads and truckloads and truckloads of data and sort of funneling it through people's PCs and stuff. And so this 42 number actually took over 1 million hours of computing time to calculate, and it's just utterly insane. So to express 42 as the sum of 3 cubes... And, okay, so I'm not going to read out what the numbers are, but, my God, we've got about, 15, 16, 17. What do you reckon, numerals in each of those numbers, there or thereabouts?
Couldn't even fashion a guess looking at it.
So they are enormous, enormous numbers, and the sum of these 3 numbers cubed gives you 42. So that is now gone as the lowest possible number that can't be expressed, as the sum of 3 cubes. And so we go to the next one, and the next lowest number is now 114. So probably people are now busy chugging away on the number 114.
Another million hours worth of computing power.
I know. And you got to ask why, but I'm sure that there's a reason behind it, because they would have had to generate an algorithm to be able to do this. And so therefore, you know, that's all adding to the sum of human knowledge.
There's a lot of supercomputers out there, and there's a lot of super nerds out there, apparently.
Amen. Yes, indeed. Yes.
And so our next story, stinking sludge.
Stinking sludge.
What's going on?
Not just stinking sludge, but actually deadly sludge. And this I had utterly no idea about, but this was reported, I think, last week, that they've gone and closed 6 beaches on the Brittany coast in France because of very dangerous seaweed and algae there.
Okay.
And you might think, yeah, well, you know, seaweed and algae, not particularly good because it gets in the waterways and everything, and then it uses up all the oxygen, all the fish die, and blah, 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 and so it's not good from that respect. However, this isn't good from a totally different respect, and this has actually killed people, which is quite astonishing, in addition to wild boars and horses, in fact.
So what causes it?
So what happens is, well, what they think happened has led to this profusion of algae and seaweed and stuff, is nitrate runoff from farming, which, you know, we have here as well. And so you get an awful lot of buildup of all of this stuff, and then it's got to decompose somehow, obviously. You know, it dies, it decomposes. And in the decomposition process, you form H2S, which is called hydrogen sulfide and commonly known as rotten egg gas, which, if you've ever been to Rotorua, which I'm sure everybody has, that's what Rotorua smells like, is H2S.
Right.
And H2S is actually really highly toxic. It's nasty stuff.
Okay.
Okay. Now, its saving grace is, in fact, the fact that it's so smelly, that you can smell it at very, very low concentrations, and so you know to basically get the hell out of there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not deadly at those very, very low concentrations. But the weird thing about this is that if you've been there for a while, your nose starts getting fatigued to it and you don't smell it anymore. And that's when it's dangerous, is when you actually don't smell it.
All right.
So what happens in France, or what they think is happening in France, is that all this algae and seaweed, they are busy decomposing. And what actually happens is that they form big pockets of H2S underneath all of the very thick layer of seaweed and stuff. And then people go and walk in this, they disturb it, you get a big bubble of H2S coming up, and bang.
Within Is it that quick?
Well,
really?
it's pretty darn quick. They reckon this horse that died went pretty darn quickly. A guy went running along the beach, stepped on some, didn't come back. A guy was shoveling the seaweed and stuff, trying to clear it out and everything. He carked it as well. So
I think that was the scariest one, is that I saw one where one of the guys who was transporting it
had
been affected by it and died from it.
So this really is a danger that I'm sure not many people realized existed, and this is utterly appalling. This is absolutely dreadful, and so they are busy at the moment cleaning out all of the seaweed and algae from these beaches in France, from these closed beaches in France.
So what's the risk of it coming over here?
Well, I guess it could potentially happen for any decomposing anything, because in the process of decomposition, you've got these sulfur-containing molecules in living things. They eventually are going to decompose to H2S, which is why, it's one of the reasons why things smell bad. You've also got amines as well, and they smell nasty as well. But H2S will be formed in the decomposition of basically any living material. So, the problem with this is that it's building up, that it's not being sort of just released into the atmosphere as it's formed. It's actually building up into these big bubbles of the stuff. You disturb them and...
Almost like landmines just sit out on the beach, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, good analogy. Yeah, yeah. So, be a little bit careful, folks, when you're wandering around bloody seaweed and stuff like that on the beach, because,
it's another reason not to go to France, by the sounds of it. Now, we've just got a text in. Somebody said, thanks, now I'm itchy in various places.
and you're thinking about saliva as well, probably.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a pint of it. Ew, gross. Well, thank you for your time, Alan, as per the usual. Best laugh on 95 BFM.
Thank you.
And always interesting, yeah.
Thanks very much. See you next fortnight.
Next fortnight? Yes. I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Plus One and 95 BFM present Joan as Policewoman, live at the Tuning Fork, October 25th. A rare stripped-down solo performance from the extraordinary Joan Wasser, playing material from her career-spanning retrospective Joanthology. Joan as Policewoman, Friday, October 25th at the Tuning Fork. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
In the market for a cleaner, healthier home? Craft Homes is your first choice. They work with you from design to project completion for a home that's minimum impact, maximum efficiency. Building Homestar 6 homes through to Passive House standard, Craft Homes are smarter, more energy efficient, and built from sustainable and environmentally friendly products. Don't just build a home. Build a more sustainable future. Craft Homes. Homestar approved practitioners. Go to crafthomes.co.nz.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, I'm looking for a flatmate in the linen that's grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticate, wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat. Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide. Every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Cotton on workers.
Summer good,
just
I mean,
isn't summer.
Jesus Christ, sorry about that, a little bit of technical difficulties. I'll hand back to you there, Will.
Thank you. Cotton on workers walked off the job on Monday to protest the company's refusal to pay them the living wage. Members of First Union picketed outside the clothing store on Queen Street in Auckland CBD. Union members have been attempting to negotiate a pay increase since April this year. However, they've stated that the latest offer they've received was, quote, worse than the first. Cotton On themselves have stated on their website that they are committed towards paying a living wage. However, workers in their retail and distribution centres are currently paid under that. Jared Abbott, First Union Secretary for Transport, Logistics and Manufacturing, has stated that Cotton On is duping customers with false claims of ethical employment practices.
He has also highlighted a severe pay equity inequity for Pacifica and Māori staff compared to their Pākehā workers. I spoke with Jared about the situation at Cotton On for its employees. I started off by asking him how Monday's strike went.
Hello. Sorry about that. We had a few technical difficulties with our machine, but we're back with Will's story right now. Please listen in.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, for us, it was really like a warning shot to the company because we've been bargaining with the company for a number of years. We've had a number of issues there over the years, and quite a few times the members have voted to take strike action, and then the company have, in the last minute, resolved the issue, and that's avoided it. And this time, I don't know if they didn't believe it was going to happen or what, but we said, you know, let's just do one day of strike just to show that we are serious and that we will actually take strike action. And it's really a precursor to, I think, what will end up being quite a large strike over Christmas if we can't resolve the current issues.
What are these issues with Cotton On that the staff have taken action against?
Well, there's a number of things, but the main thing is that we want our workers to be earning a living wage. Cotton On is one of these companies that put out all these policies and promote themselves as being ethical, and one of their global policies that they promote is that they pay living wages, but they pay nothing like it. In reality, what they're actually trying to do is cut staff's wages down to the minimum wage where they're currently above it. They also want to remove break times and stuff like that. And this is at a time where the company is making huge profits and growing internationally. But it's just a typical example, I guess, of what's been happening in the corporate space lately around corporate responsibility, where these companies have these policies that are similar to like greenwashing, where they try and pretend that they're environmental when they're nothing like that. It's the same thing happening across the corporate world, where they have all these corporate responsibility documents and policies that they can advertise and try and make out that they're these great corporate citizens, when really they're nothing of it. They're there to exploit people and make as much profit as they can. The owner of Cotton On is a guy called Nigel Austin, who's actually one of the richest men in Australia, and he's entirely made his money off the back of low-wage workers.
Yeah, because it says on Cotton On's website that, just to directly quote it, that they're committed to the journey towards paying a living wage. Would you say that this is a lie from their recent actions or just their actions overall?
Yeah, it's complete rubbish. And when we confronted them about it, they said, oh, well, look, you know, we have about 30 staff in the support centre that are paid more than the living wage, and everyone in the company has the opportunity to get one of those jobs, and that's the pathway to the living wage. Now, if you do the maths, like we got all the statistics off them of the amount of turnover, how many staff they have and all this, it works out that less than 0.1% of employees would actually be able to get there under their current regime. So to say that 0.1% of your employees can achieve a living wage as a pathway to paying living wages is a joke, you know? Like 99.9% of companies would get a better ratio than that of people paid above the living wage, and they don't advertise it, you know? If you're gonna pay the living wage, then you pay it to everyone. And the only time I think a company should really be saying, well, look, we can't afford to pay the living wage, is when they're really struggling and they're not profiting or not making huge profits, when they're still in like a growth or expansion or going through hard times. But this is a company that literally makes millions and millions of dollars. There's no shortage of money going through there. They've never once said that they can't afford it. It's literally just a case of, well, I think it's more important to them that Mr. Nigel Austin goes up the rich list than it is to have the staff that work for them earn enough to live off.
Just to clarify, what is the living wage at the moment for New Zealand?
So the current living wage is calculated at $21.15 an hour, and this is done by an independent statistician from the universities, and it's basically based off what it would take to support, you know, a family on 1.5 incomes. In reality, in Auckland, the living wage is probably closer to around $26 an hour or more, but it's based on a national average. And one of the things that's really frustrating about dealing with Cotton On is they keep saying, oh, well, we don't need to pay living wages to our retail staff because they're all students and they probably still live with their parents and stuff like that. In reality, the cost of being a student is actually really expensive. But also what the company is proposing is that the retail staff are paid more than the distribution centre workers, which is made up of entirely full-time dedicated staff based in South Auckland almost 100% Pacific Islander or Polynesian workers. And as we've seen from recent statistics that have come out about the wage gap between Pacific Island and Takiha workers, is that it's larger than the gender wage gap. And this, to me, is just another company exploiting that opportunity. They want to set up their main distribution centre, which covers the whole of New Zealand in South Auckland, pay the lowest wages possible. And I think the statistics are like average Pacific Island woman earns around $23 an hour, average white Pākehā man earns around $33 an hour. And then if you actually look at what Cotton On are paying, like the top rate is around $18.50, $19 an hour. So the wages range from $17.70 through to $19 an hour. That's pretty poor and there's really no excuse for it.
Just about the pay inequity within Cotton On, why do you think that occurs?
I genuinely believe that that they set up in places like South Auckland where they can start it with Polynesian migrant workers, pay them next to nothing and really exploit the profits from it. I mean, the amount of money that they must make by having these kind of models, even across their whole business, to be fair, they are consistent in how they exploit people. I mean, we have people in the retail stores that, you know, they store their stores with one staff member who's not paid as a supervisor or anything like that, so they're all alone. We've had reports of people that have had to, like, go to the toilet in buckets because they're not allowed to close their store. You know, whenever there's bad customers or aggravated customers and stuff like that, there's no one there for them to feel in any way secure, and they're not recognised for that. I mean, you would think at the very least if you're alone working in a store that you'd be recognised above the minimum wage, but these people aren't. They guarantee workers 3 hours a week, so every worker's always hungry for more hours, and it's kind of like just systematically set up to allow them to really get around everything they can. Even the way they roster, you know, like they don't put rosters out in advance. They constantly reschedule people in order to be able to avoid paying public holidays properly, avoid paying people when they shut down on Easter Sunday and stuff like that. We have a lot of issues of them changing time cards of people to fit within their budgets. These workers who are on like minimum wage or very close to minimum wage, guaranteed a minimum 3 hours a week, and then doing overtime and basically not being paid for it because the manager wants to fit within their store budget. It's endless. And we've had situations like it was reported a couple of years ago and again a couple of years before that where we did audits on the company and found tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars in unpaid holiday pay, unpaid overtime. And we're going through a similar issue with them now.
It sounds like that the non-committal to paying the living wage and the pay equity are not the only problems that these workers are dealing with at Cotton On. Are there any other issues that they're facing?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that I talked about are the other issues, but I think there are remedies for us to deal with those through the employment authority and stuff like that, and that's the process we're going through at the moment. So really what these strikes are about getting living wages. And we want living wages, or at least a genuine pathway to the living wage for all the workers. We've been really active in the last few years, our union and across various companies, and we've won these living wages in companies like The Warehouse, Bunnings, Kmart, H&M, and we've won them by basically organising workers and taking collective action or threatening collective action. And this is basically what we're doing again. I mean, our union has a policy of that we believe all workers deserve at least a living wage. I mean, you know, why should people work for less than they can live off? Companies don't keep operating when they're not making profit. So why is it that workers are meant to run their life at a loss while companies are making profit? Doesn't make sense. So we're not ashamed to go out and say, actually, we don't want a 3% increase or a 2% increase. We want enough to get people up to something they can live off, whatever it takes. And that's, I guess, what we're going through.
You've mentioned that you've fought for better treatment of workers at other stores. How does Cotton On's treatment of their staff compare to other retail stores?
Pretty poorly. I mean, the understaffing, the low rates of pay, the fact that they allow managers to be able to change time cards and that, the lack of response from their human resources and payroll departments when pay discrepancies are raised, it's very poor, to be honest. It's unbelievable. And, you know, we constantly refer to them as a company that is a serial committer of wage theft, because that's what they do. They steal off workers.
You said that the most recent offer was worse than the first since you initiated negotiations with Cotton On. Could you clarify the differences in this and why it's worse?
Yeah, so initially they were offering about a 0.9% increase and for a one-year term, and then basically that was rejected. And this 0.9% increase, which would have worked out as roughly about 15 cents an hour for the workers, that was to apply from 1st of April. That went out to vote. The members rejected it, rightfully. And then they came back and said, well, we're not going to backdate any payment. Instead, we're going to offer you what would be the equivalent of a 2% increase, but we're actually going to take away paid rest breaks from you that are worth 2.1%. So it worked out as a pay cut. And then they said, and we want a two-year term. And in the second year, we want to remove an existing clause that requires that they don't drop workers below 3% above minimum wage in the retail stores. So if you work it out, like, you know, if people stayed on their existing contract right now, they'll actually earn more money over the next 18 months than if they agreed to what the company's offering now. So what they're actually offering is a pay cut.
What kind of a deal or improvement are you hopefully looking for, or are you seeking for these workers?
We want the living wage. I mean, we've proposed to the company a pathway to get there, so it would take them 2 years basically to like stagger up the rates, so that over the period of 2 years they would eventually reach what would be the living wage at the time. The company just haven't entertained it at all. But I mean, this is it. It's like, if you're not going to give people a pathway to the living wage, stop pretending that's what you do. Stop advertising it. Stop making out you're an ethical company. I mean, these companies, like, you know, people need to get real as consumers and think about, if you can go into a store and pay $10, $20 for a top or pants and stuff like that, of course it's being made by slave labor. Of course people are being exploited all the way through the supply chain, and of course the company are cutting corners wherever they can to get the products to be that cheap. I mean, they rip off other companies' designs. They get the stuff produced for next to nothing in exploited countries. They have really bad ratings by all the auditing agencies, and yet these auditing agencies aren't effective as in themselves in being able to access workers and stuff. And then in countries like New Zealand and Australia, where they're making massive profit, they're known as the lowest paying brands. They give nothing back to the community of those countries, yet constantly paint themselves out to be some amazing organisation. And it's the kind of, like, if you walked into this distribution centre, literally every single wall is covered with posters with, like, friendly catchphrases about how important their staff are to them and how everything is about their people and helping people out and their pathways and all this kind of stuff. But it's all just rubbish. No one believes it.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about this?
Just if you are out shopping, ideally until this dispute's resolved, I'd recommend people stay away from Cotton On. But if you are shopping in there, you know, like, don't be shy just to say it's good to see you workers are fighting for stuff and that you support people getting paid a living wage. And also, you know, like, we will be causing more disruptions as things go on, and we are likely to probably shut down their supply chain leading up to the Christmas period. So, you know, like, apologies to people that will be disrupted by that, consumers and that. But I think it's an important fight that needs to be fought to ensure that, you know, we keep more money in the New Zealand community and less money being sent overseas.
That was Jared Abbott of First Union, Secretary for Transport, Logistics and Manufacturing, talking about pay inequity and unethical treatment of Cotton On workers. We've had a text in. Somebody said, nothing's playing. And to that, I'd just like to say, I'm sorry. I'm pretty sure the machine just, I think it just shat itself, didn't it? It seems like it. We'll be right back after these very short messages.
Summer just isn't summer without Laneway. So praise the sun. It's back for another year of unforgettable music from here and around the world.
Featuring The 1975,
Rufus Du Sol,
Charlie XCX,
Rule,
Earl Sweatshirt,
King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard,
Benny,
J.I.D.,
Mahalia,
Baby No Money,
The Chats,
Hockey Dad,
Julia Jacklin,
Coltrane,
shit, this is pretty good,
Fontaines DC,
Stella Donnelly,
Omar Apollo,
Kait,
Soaked Oats,
1174,
Mermaidens, and more to be announced. St. Jerome's Laneway Festival 2020, Auckland Anniversary Day, January 27th, in luscious Albert Park.
Tickets on sale 9 a.m. Thursday, September 26th. Go to lanewayfestival.co.nz.
This
This week at the Hollywood Avondale.
Thursday at 8 p.m, Convoy. Chris Christopherson in modern day trucking western by the legendary Sam Peckinpah. Sunday at 2 p.m, Change of Habit. Elvis Presley's last film role as a hip young doctor alongside Mary Tyler Moore, who is secretly a nun.
The other night when I put my arms around you, it was no accident. It was intentional.
Then at 5 p.m, it's David Lynch's beautifully weird sci-fi epic, Dune. See the original before the remake.
There's no sign of the carry-all. I think they've got our carry-all.
And on Thursday, September 12th, it's David Cronenberg's excellent remake of The Fly. Plus, everything is on 35mm. Come early. Every screening has pre-show oddities, plus vegan treats and mulled wine.
The Hollywood Avondale, your local independent church of cinema.
Are you a dick?
Nah.
Do you like yummy food?
Oh, yeah.
Well, then what's for dinner tonight?
Well, I was thinking...
Wrong. What you need is a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make Lucky Tacos at home in just 10 minutes. Tasty, spicy, fresh, Lucky Tacos make you feel good. And with free delivery in Auckland, why not make it a ritual? Pick up a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit at your local Faro Fresh or get free delivery direct from the HQ at theluckytaco.co.nz.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art.
Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
September features Theo Parrish, Cakes to Killer, Nah Noise, and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. We do.
The Wire.
Welcome back. I did a report on the Operation Birmingham inquiries that are currently going on at the moment. I did a little bit of research into the actual event itself, so what took place, and I talked to some very interesting people about what happened afterwards. Here it is.
Early in the morning, well before the light blue hue that warns of the sun's impending arrival had washed into the sky, cut deep into the jagged and isolated Turgeran Valley, two villages lay dormant. On August 22, 2010, New Zealand SAS soldiers, supported by Afghan and US troops, descended into those dark lowlands. They were in search of the Taliban group responsible for the death of Lieutenant Tim O'Donnell 19 days prior. O'Donnell was New Zealand's first casualty in the Afghanistan War. He was the recipient of New Zealand Distinguished Service Decoration for rescuing some 600 people from an ambush during a political rally and was a highly competent and widely liked officer. As well as being brave, Chief of the New Zealand Defence Force at the time, Jerry Matapaere himself, described O'Donnell as a free spirit. O'Donnell was ambushed by an IED explosion, followed by small arms fire while on patrol in the Bayamon province. He died after the ensuing firefight. The SAS wanted blood, and so the call was made. Two helicopters made their way from a nearby Kiwi base to the two villages of Naik and Khachudaidad, carrying some 60-odd soldiers within them. One after the other, each village was attacked. As soon as boots touched the ground, bullets followed closely behind. Troops exchanged fire with who they thought were insurgents and destroyed homes they believed were housing them. Apache gunships lent their firepower as well, destroying buildings and strafing the village of Naik shortly after the initial ground assault. But when the dust settled over the rubble and the wounded and the dead, no Taliban were found. These events were detailed in John Stevenson and Nicky Hager's book Hit and Run. Stevenson and Hager claim that for almost a decade, the NZDF, or New Zealand Defence Force, have been trying to cover up these events. The book has since triggered an inquiry, with many officials and even authors themselves being called in to discuss the matter. I spoke to Sarah Atkin from the Hit and Run campaign, a spokesperson for the protest group, that have been very keen to know exactly what happened that night.
The Hit and Run inquiry campaign has been going for like the last 2 years since the inquiry, just since before the inquiry started. Initially it was formed to actually ask for an inquiry, and since it has been going, our main focus of the campaign is to make sure that the truth is being told and that we're keeping the pressure on the Defence Force and not allowing their narrative of lies and cover-ups to be the dominant narrative, basically.
Like you just said earlier, you're trying to sort of expose the truth. Do you think you could explain to me, in your eyes, what you think the truth is? What is that?
I think that the truth is that our New Zealand SAS forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan in 2010 in the Tigran Valley villages. There were civilian casualties, including the death of a three-year-old girl named Fatima. She would be 11 this year. A young man named Islamuddin, who had just graduated from Teachers College and was coming home to visit his family before he was to start his new job, and was killed when he was...
And that kind of leads me to my next question, which is, why do you do what you do? Is it because do you think that you have sort of a personal stake in what happened with the tragedy that allegedly, so the NZ Defence Force would like to say, allegedly took place? Or is it because you have a personal stake in that? Or is it because you just feel like there was a wrong that was done and we need to fix it?
The New Zealand Defence Force, it represents New Zealand as a whole. So whatever the Defence Force does, it reflects the rest of this country. And so basically that means that if they act in a way that the public aren't happy with, then they should be held account to that. The New Zealand Defence Force should not be above the laws of this country. They should be held to account for their war crimes.
Has the New Zealand Defence Force responded to you in any way? And if so, how was that? How did they respond?
Yes, for example, they have responded earlier last year. So basically, some members of the campaign group had been putting up posters and paper banners around Wellington City, basically encouraging the inquiry to not take the side of the Defence Force and encouraging the Defence Force to tell the truth. And we were noticing that these banners were pretty much coming down as quickly as we were putting them up. So we did an OIA asking the Wellington City Council if they knew anything about what had been happening with these banners and who was taking them down. And we found out that actually the Defence Force was requesting via the City Council, that our banners would be taken, that the banners for the campaign would be taken down.
Holy shit, really?
And so the Defence Force, with their millions and millions and millions of dollars, for their PR campaign, are taking down the banners of basically a protest group that care about the lives of those who were lost in Afghanistan.
Now, you touched on it a little bit earlier about putting up picket signs and signs, obviously, that were taken down. Wow, I can't believe that. So I was just wondering what else, what other kind of activities do you, does the group kind of get themselves involved with?
One of the things that we've done is do leaflets, or hand out leaflets outside the Defence Force headquarters on Molesworth Street. We've had prayer vigils at different occasions in connection with other groups. We have done banner drops outside the module hearings. Yeah, just trying to engage with the inquiry at whatever level that we can.
Speaking to Sarah made it clear that the Defence Force had something to hide. Next, I spoke to Thomas Nash, a lecturer at Massey University who has been openly critical of the New Zealand Defence Force and the events that took place the night of the raid.
Yeah, so I think the decision by any country to send its troops into war, into conflict, is a decision that carries great responsibility and great consequences. I mean, I think we need to have a better conversation in New Zealand about when and why we send our troops into conflict. This inquiry is not directly about that, though. This inquiry is about what happens during war when our troops are in conflict situations. And what I think is really important about this inquiry is that it's going to shine a light on the reality of war. And the reality of war is not just that soldiers get killed and injured, it's also that civilians get killed and injured, and that includes children. And that is what happened in this case. Children and civilians were killed during an operation. And we need to be able to get to the bottom of this. We owe it to ourselves as a country, and we owe it to the people whose countries we go to fight in. And so that's why I really think this inquiry needs to get it right. And I think also after the inquiry, there'll need to be some reforms made to the way the New Zealand Defence Force operates and to the way the government looks into situations where civilians have been killed and injured during operations that involve New Zealand.
How aware do you think New Zealanders are of the kind of things that happen overseas in terms of the activities that our Defence Force engage? How sort of clued up do you think the average Kiwi is?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think there's a lot of understanding about the role of the New Zealand Defence Forces in the US-led wars in the Middle East over the past couple of decades. I think if you ask people what the New Zealand Defence Forces do, people would probably instinctively say, oh, they do relief work in the Pacific and they help patrol our marine area and, you know, they were helping to rebuild Afghanistan after the war and things like that, or peacekeeping. And, you know, some of that is true, but what's kind of, I mean, all of that is true, but what is also true is that we have been involved through our SAS in combat operations in US-led wars. And I just don't think we've had a proper national conversation about that, about why we chose to do that, about what the implications are from that, and about what happened during those operations. And I think a healthy society is a society that can have those sorts of conversations, and also strong institutions are institutions that can be self-critical and be self-reflective. And I think the New Zealand Defence Forces could really benefit from some self-criticism, some self-reflection, and I think would be a stronger institution for that.
Now, it's interesting you say that, because I'd like to touch on something you said earlier, and you kind of implied that maybe New Zealanders don't really know or don't really have a grasp or just on how, just on the sort of activities that the New Zealand Defence Force gets involved with. Do you think that that is something that's actively propagated by the New Zealand Defence Force? Do you think that they sort of suppress or push down any information, like Operation Birmingham itself, for an example? Do you think that they push that down to the public?
Well, I mean, one of the things about special forces, which our NZSC is a special forces unit, they do tend to be subject to more secrecy. That's something that is just a fact, right?
I mean, I'm interested. Do you think that that's justified, just in terms of this specific example, right? Because obviously, you know, outfits like the SAS, they require that secrecy. But personally, I don't know if in this particular instance it was justified. You know what I mean? At what point do you say fuck the secrecy and you ask them, you know, what have you been up to?
Yeah, I mean, I think usually the justification for the secrecy around special forces operations is on the one hand, not to jeopardise the outcome of those operations, and on the other hand, to protect the individuals themselves who've been involved. But I don't think either of those objectives would stop the scrutiny post facto of an operation like Operation Burnham. And I think it's been a real failure, actually, let's be honest. The way that the institution, and not just the SAS and not just the Defence Forces, but the wider kind of government response to the aftermath of Operation Burnham, it's been a failure. And you know, some will say it's been a cover-up deliberately. It's very difficult to know what's actually gone on, and that's why the public inquiry is so important. But it does look like there was some efforts to obfuscate in some way.
I like that word, obfuscate. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were efforts to obfuscate by the Defence Forces on this, and that's not to say everybody involved was trying to do a cover up or even that it was a coordinated cover up by the government. And overall, I mean, we that could be the case, but we don't know. But what is definitely clear is that there were efforts to draw people off the trail, basically, and I think that is not the mark of a strong, confident, mature institution. And I think we would hope that our armed forces would be a strong and confident institution that is open to robust criticism and scrutiny. I mean, that is the fundamental pillar on which the Defence Forces are supposed to rest, is civilian civilian governance and control. Otherwise, you start to get into a very, very difficult territory if your armed forces become a law unto themselves.
The inquiries will no doubt yield some damning information New Zealand will have a tough time reflecting on. But instead of focusing on what was hidden, I think it is important to remember what was lost.
The civilians and the families of those that were killed are still suffering. Like, their villages haven't been rebuilt 10 years later. So I think it's important to remember the actual victims of this and refocus on that. I think that this point in the inquiry is actually a turning point, because this hearing, unlike the ones that have gone previously, the previous hearings, the first three, were actually quite tokenistic, kind of irrelevant to the actual focus of the inquiry. And this hearing that we're that's been played out this week is actually a lot more significant, because these top brass military hierarchy are being sort of made to, you know, shake in their boots a bit.
Yeah,
like, this is actually getting serious, and I think this is the turning point that the inquiry needs to actually start making some proper progress.
Tu Whenuoroa Ngā Tanihira, reporting for 95BFM.
Now, just at the end of that, I'd like to say that I did reach out to the New Zealand Defence Force for a comment. They did not want an interview, but they did say that the NZDF is fully participating in and supporting the government inquiry into Operation Birmingham and related matters. The NZDF has no further comment to make on this matter.
That was The Wire.
That brings us to the end of a somewhat rocky show today, but it wasn't too bad, I think. Thank you to all of our guests that we had on the show today. Thank you to Alan Blackman, Jared Abbott, Sarah Atkins and Thomas Nash. And of course, thank you to Will for keeping me company in the studio and of course producing as well. You can catch all of these at 95bfm.com. Go to our podcast lists. So yeah, up next is the 1 to 4 with Bridge. You're listening to 95BFM.
That caper, trick that boy and tip that shaker. He forfeiting all that paper. Niggas coughing off that ether. I wanna hit them beepers. This S40 bitch, that gamer. They calling me super sicker. Hit that. I'm just really out here living. Something like the new edition. They say I'm poison. What's the difference? BBD, Michael Wiggins. All my bad bitches do it. Bad bitches do it. All my bad bitches do it. Dusty bitches jello, I'm rising up with that ghetto. It's that time to get that bezel. Dining with that cello, freaky fine, a China fella. He pumping banana yellow. Get that. Let me get that. When they get that ooh, fine feminine with that woo. Dram, dram, and niggas get that deuce. Ram, bam, lamb, flip that loo. Gam, champ, jiggy, jam on loop. Damn, fam, what you mean gon' do? I get it when they whip that woo. I spend it when they spend that loot. Wildin' with my bitches, I be stylin' with my bitches. Pretty eyes and long extensions, they smilin' and all them bitches.
bitches. I be rising with my bitches, riding with my bitches. We the finest of them bitches. It's diamonds, we diamond dish. We get that ice, nigga, bitch. Wanna freeze like white winner. She need the G's that price. When up, she need to see that bright shimmer. He wanna see that nice, wanna fit that slice, wanna see that space. She want it with that white, nigga, peachy, pinky, pipe, nigga. Bees with the bees, little bees by the C-A-Z, been about that life, nigga. Tits out with your wife, nigga. I'm bringing out the dike in a XOXO fine, scissors, sister, 69. With that, I get it when I get that. I spend it when I'm with that. Let me get that, let me get that, ooh. When I spit that, I'ma spit that, ooh. When I hit that, let me hit that, ooh. Get it when it gets that, oh, I spend it when it's in that, oh.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.